Off a little steam. So I'll try to go back as far as my memory goes. Well, to begin with, we lived in a little mining town in California. It was Weaverville. It was about 50 miles out of Redding. And my father was driving stage them days, and back in our place where they had a... The gold was from the grassroots down to bedrock, was about 3 feet. And whenever he could find water enough, took his rocker out there and rocked out a little gold. So then, I had an uncle who was a hard rock man from Colorado. So he heard of Joe Juna's strike. So he come through, and he stopped off to see us. He's married to my father's sister. And so he stayed there about a week, and by that time my father made up his mind he was coming to Alaska too. So they hit out, and so they went up to Juneau in 96, and they staked some claims around the Silver Bow Basin. I don't know if any of you people here tonight had been there or not in them days. So there wasn't too much doing in the hard rock, it was a slow process. So then the stampede started to Dawson. So they thought they'd go up to Skagway and take a look at Skagway and go over to Dyea. And so when they got took in both places, why, most of the travel was over the Dyea, the Chukut Trail. So they sent down to Seattle, and my father did, and he brought up 3 teams of horses, and they started freighting. So most of their travel was over the Chukut because it was shorter them days. But it was a tough job. Every bit of freight you had to put on your back and pack it up. So they had 3 teams to go, and you wonder how quick this freight would disappear because it had to be put on the human's back and up over the pass. So that was in 96, and my father, he sent for us in 97. Well, that was a slow battle too, because we had to take a train out of Redding, and in them days there's no bridge across the Columbia, and they put the trains on the ferry and took them across there, and we landed in Seattle. So when we got into Seattle, there's 2 boats laying there, is ready to go north, and there was old Rosalie and the old city of Seattle. So my mother, she took the city of Seattle, and so we went up to Juneau. And my father and my uncle was building 2 houses there in Dyea, and they hadn't been finished, so we laid over in Juneau. And so we got a letter from him and said everything was all ready, come on up to Dyea. So the first boat in was the old steamer Farallon. She was an old hard hell of a boat. So we took that from Juneau and went up to Dyea, and we got in there. It was dark and there was no docks. And we had to climb over the ladder and go down in the lifeboats. And then they took us in the lifeboats as far as we could go and hit the beach, and then you had to jump on the sailor's back and he'd pack you ashore. And so the wind was blowing to beat the van. You know how Lynn Connell is. And so one man grabbed my little sister, my younger sister, and he took her. She was pretty cold, and he took her off, run off with her, and we didn't know who he was or anything. And my dad was there with the team, so we all piled in the wagon. There's only my 2 sisters and myself. My mother had left the other 2 sisters and Juneau to the convent. So we went up, and Harry didn't have the house finished. So we had to go into a tent. It was about 12 or about 14. That was a nice place, but you had to keep shoving the wood into the old Yukon stove. And so my mother, while she's putting the team of horses away and everything, she looked around, and all we could smell was beans and sow bellies. And so everything else was canned meat them days, and everything was canned. Of course, there was a bag of Oh, our book was coffee, but it was roasted, but it wasn't ground. You had to grind it yourself. And so she looked around, and she didn't see nothing. So she looked over, and here was a bunch of hardtack. And so she thought she'd put some of that on the stove, and there's a can of this St. Charles milk. That was the first can of milk I ever seen. And she diluted that into the hardtack, and she sprinkled a little nutmeg and cinnamon over it and soaked it, and it was Thanksgiving Day. And that was our dinner, sow belly and beans and hardtack. So about a week while we moved into our home, and everything was going fine. But then my uncle, he thought he'd go down and see his wife, as my Aunt Emma, at Juna. So I remember my mother turned the lining out of his coat and filled it up with these greenbacks. Them days it was the old greenbacks, the gold, paper money. So he had to go over to Skagway to take this boat. This boat had come up from Seattle, and she was loaded with blasting powder for Berners Bay. So he went over to Chicago, and he took this boat, and I don't forget just how many passengers, but there's 60 or more passengers I know. And she took on the passengers, and just before she got into Berners Bay, she blew up. And out of all these passengers and the crew, why, there's only one passenger ever found, and he washed up on the beach, and that was the purser. I guess it was so much powder and everything, it just blew them all to pieces. So that ended that career, and so my dad carried on. And so then, the next year they put in a tramway to carry the freight up to the top of the summit from Canyon there. And that knocked lots of men out of their job because they were carrying freight on their back up the hill. And in the meantime, old Sophie Smith and White, they fought it out and shot it out one night. And I remember they all scattered, and they come over to dinner, wanted to come over to Dyea, and the bunch of down at Dyea there on the beach didn't want to let them in. Of course, old Sophie had the shell games running on the Skagway and then both on the Chilkoot Pass too. And I seen a lot of these boys would come up and they'd meet the shell game, and of course they'd clean them, and the first thing you know they'd be hitting back. And of course maybe they missed lots of hardship because they'd pass coal or stole away or something, get back on the boat to Seattle. And then after that, my dad, he could see it was coming to the end because they finished in the White Pass Railroad. So he sold all his horses to the railroad, and I had an older sister. She fell on the ice and she got hip disease. So he said, we'll go back down to Tacoma. There's a good doctor there. And so he took us down to Tacoma and got us located, and my sister, she went through 7 operations where they keep it taken out of bone, you know. And my dad then in 1900, why, he says, I'll hit back north after he got us located. And he went into Whitehorse and he stayed there that winter, and then the next year he went into Dawson. Well, we're still all in Tacoma. And so in 1903 I had another uncle by the name of Fred Norris. He was in the lumber business there. And so when he heard of the Puget strike in 1903, why, my uncle and my dad, they come down to Fairbanks, and they started a sawmill over there where Crafton Furniture is. And he run that for years, and then in 1904, why, my dad sent for the family to come on in. And so everything went along fine. My uncle did fine in the lumber business. In them days, they used a lot of lumber for the sluice boxes and for to carry the water. They didn't have all the stuff they have nowadays. And he was putting out a lot of lumber, 1x10s and 1x12. Of course, was good timber around here them days. And he followed the sawmill business then. Now, if I get to talking too long, I say we'll adjourn.
Don't worry about that.
And so he went along there for years. Well, there was two other mills here, Carroll and Parker, and the Town Hall Mill Company. And so Carroll and Parker, they went out of business, and then he bought the Town Hall Mill out, and then he started a mill down there where the FE Company is today. Some of the old buildings are there yet. And it went along. Of course, he did fine because the big fire there was leveled Fairbanks there in 1906 or 7. I could sell all the lumber you'd produce. And he did it really good. And then, but going back to 1904 when we come in, I would live in the cabin that winter. And so I went to school that winter, and they had a little school over here where the Northwood building is now. And Miss Heilig was our teacher. I think there was 25 or 30 of us. And I went to school that winter, and of course next year the population growed, and they built another schoolhouse on the for Second and Noble. And in the meantime, Miss Heilig went off and got married to a man by the name of Force. He was in charge of the NAT&T company. It was a transportation company then. So then when they started the school on this other place, her uncle, I think it was Fred Heilig, he took over as principal, and they hired a Mrs. Bruce, and the Mrs. Fairburn was the first teachers there. And of course with me, I'd missed school so much, you know, and traveling to Dyea and Tacoma and so forth, and I wasn't in interested in school too much. All I thought I needed was a strong back. So the first winter, Donning and Gardner, they were freighting, and they had the mail contract between here and Circle, and they were running dog teams, and then they had about 16 or 20 head of horses and mules. So I got that job that winter. In between school, I was a chambermaid in the barn. I had to clean up the barn and put in the sawdust. And so everything went fine. And then the next year, they started bringing cattle in from the States. And they always arrived here. They had to come up over the railroad from the White Pass and down the Yukon and up here, and they brought them up on barges. So I went to herding cattle. In California, all my uncles were cattlemen, and they used to take me with them all the time. And so Donnie and Gardner would give me a job of herding cattle, and of course there's Wechter brothers here then too. And I herded cattle all that summer, and the next fall I went back to school again. And about the middle of the winter, I thought I knew enough, so I thought I'd quit school. And every summer I'd go back to herding cattle. Well, them days the dance halls were running. They had four dance halls here then. Gambling was wide open. And so up until about 1909, I was herding cattle every summer and going to school in the winter. And then my sister was running a boarding house down here on 2nd Avenue.
What was her name?
Mrs. Stroker, Maddie.
Maddie Stroker.
Yeah. And so I just come in from off from herding, and so Bill Coons, Martin Coons, they own the California Saloon, so I said, and he says, come over here, Creamer. I walked over and talked to him, and he says, our bowling alleys have got a flop. And he says, one of you take them over. And he says, we'll give you 2/3 and furnish everything. God, I didn't know nothing about bowling alleys or anything, you know. So I went down and talked to my sister. Well, she says, why don't you get old Winnie Groom? He's a little guy, was kind of a fella do around here. He did a chore around, and for for this one and that one.
What was his name?
Winnie Groom. He was
Winnie.
Kind of a little dwarf. So my sister says, go talk to Winnie. She says, I've heard him talk about bowling alleys. So I got a hold of Winnie and I put the cards on the table to him and told him what Coombs had offered us. So I had to get 2/3, so I split a third with him. So he said, all right. So he knew all about bowling alleys. So we went in and we sandpapered these alleys and we took some acid and put on them to turn them all white. It's hard maple, you know. And we gave him a couple of coats of shellac. And we started up. Gosh, in a week of time, from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to 4 o'clock in the morning, them alleys were just filled up. Of course, we only got 2 bits a man, you know. But our biggest money was after 1 o'clock when the dance hall closed down. The girls would bring down their boyfriends and they go to bowling. Well, the tips was more than we could make all day setting pins. Well, we did a good business that winter, and so when spring came again, I went back herding. So then, when I come in that fall, Coombs got a hold of me again, and he asked me if I'd run the pool table. Well, the dance halls and everything had shut down. So I took over the pool. They had 10 pool tables and 2 billiard alleys, and that year they had a strike and they brought all these Russians in and the people from the Slav countries.
Who had the strike?
The miners.
Miners.
You see, they was on a 10-hour day and they was asking for an 8-hour day. And they brought all these Russians in and none of them could talk English. It was good. And they had this interpreter. Well, the interpreter, he's living in Fairbanks, yet I won't mention no names. And there was an old Montenegrin there, his name was Pete Vitovich. He was kind of a miser, you know, and nobody knew about his business, but he had plenty of money. I don't know where he got it, but he'd loan out money to all these different places around town. We always knew where he loaned money because he'd go in and sit around and watch. And so he could talk the foreign languages, and with him, and so they'd come in every day and they were dashed like these Cossacks, you know, with these long coats on and everything. Mm. And the poor fellows, I felt sorry for them because they couldn't talk any. They just come in and sit down. Well, this California was quite a place. And upstairs, by the Miners Association and the laymen, they all had their place upstairs there. And so at the night after about 7 o'clock, that bar kept about 4 bartenders busy, besides the boys shoving the stuff up the elevator to the Miners Association. And so then they brought in moving pictures. They're the first one to bring moving pictures in, and they were free.
Free?
Yeah. They did that. Of course, a picture show would go along for 2 weeks before they gave pictures again. And so I'll never forget this Coon. He had his house right on the end of this California saloon, and he cut a bunch of little peepholes. And of course, all the women them days we called, was married and everything and so forth, we call them square guys.
Square guys.
Yeah. So these square guys, they want to see the picture show, so old Bill will let him come up and look through these people. So it went along then, and then of course everything went dry, and that changed the proposition. And then we went along, and after herding cattle and everything, and then of course the railroad bill went through, and I'll never forget the night of the big railroad celebration. Why, the women could never go in saloons.
Until then?
No. You never seen a square guy in a saloon. So And they had the celebration. I don't know how many of you people were here that night. Any of you?
No hands.
So everybody had to be masked. And they used the Eagle Hall and this old auditorium down here, the
Moose Hall.
Moose Hall. And you could go between. And of course the women all put on masks and they could go in the bars. And believe me, that was sure was a blowout. It went for about 24 hours.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
This is when Congress okayed building the railroad.
Yeah, the railroad, yeah. Mm-hmm. So and then in later years, I worked for the railroad. And then when the war started, I started drafting the boys. And of course, I was a little bit over the age. And so I seen all my friends are going, so I had to go down and join too. And of course we won the war, you know. I was back in Des Moines, Iowa, in Camp Grant, Illinois.
Where'd you join, up here or out there?
I joined here, and they took us down to Gibbon, and we laid there at Gibbon for about 3 weeks, and we waited for the General Jacobs, the steamer, to come up and get us. And she put us all on a barge and we went down to St. Michael. And when we got to St. Michael, we had to lay there at the post for about a month. And there was a big transport come in there, they called it the Sherman.
Sherman.
And she just come back from Russia, and she had all these Russians or Americans on was coming back. And so, we boarded her, and of course we had to pick up the soldiers there at St. Michael's. We were the first one, and believe me, it was rough that night. Every time they took us out on a barge, you know, and every time the barge and the boat would come together, we'd make a jump for the ladder. But then we had to go over to Nome and pick up the boys there. And then when we pulled out of Nome, the first night out on the Sherman, they put me on guard. I was up on the back end there on what they call the poop deck. So I went up there and we pulled out of Nome, and believe me, we hit rough weather. And it took us a whole week before we got through Unimak Pass.
A week to get that far?
It took a week, and we tossed around, and I talked to the captain, and he said he hadn't been up there since 96. And there was no sun, and he couldn't get his bearings or anything. And so I'd been up there for about 36 hours, and here comes a sergeant along, and he says, "I'll relieve you," and he says, "Go on down." And what was an old cattle boat, you know, it was just deck after deck after deck. So he relieved me, and I started down, and go down the hole. The rowing was so goddamn strong from these boys being sick. I had a hit for the upper deck.
Right away. I know what you mean.
So, and this wasn't a small boat. She was over 600 feet long. And I know that night out there, when her rear end had come up, you see their propellers where it was in the air. So, when the fog raised and the storm was over, I often wondered how this captain ever got in there. We landed in what they call the Farallone Rocks. I don't know if you ever seen them or not, but they're just pinnacles down here on Bering Sea.
No, I never have.
And how he got in there without landing on these rocks. So then we started out from there and we went over to Seward and picked up a bunch there. And then after we left Seward, I then went over to Fort Luscombe, Laird Valdez, and picked up another bunch. But the food was so doggone rotten. I think the crew left the holes open so the salt water can go in to Gilligan. So we bought a bunch of food at Seward. And we lived pretty good because, of course, one night you go down there and these guys would sell you anything you wanted, the crew. And so after we picked up the bunch of Valdez, but you wouldn't believe it, after leaving St. Michael's, we were 3 weeks getting to Frisco.
3 weeks?
Yeah, on the transport.
Okay.
And I'll never forget, last morning was on the transport, and I said, we're going to treat you. They're going to give us boiled legs.
Boiled legs?
Well, not to get the boiled eggs, we couldn't get up to them. There's a bunch of these Chinese eggs.
Oh, yeah.
I guess they're 2 or 3 years old.
They was going to get rid of them.
Well, then when we had a Frisco, we stayed there the Presidio about a couple of weeks. And of course, we had a good time, and everything was open, but we couldn't have a drink or do a darn thing, you know. But I had a friend, well, this Martin Malone from California, he was running a place down on the Barbary Coast. Mm-hmm. So when we got there, I went down and seen Ed, and everything was to us. We couldn't spend 2 bits or anything.
Sure enough.
Had a nice big car, and Billy Ward, he was carrying papers for the Fairbanks Times, and they had the Granada Hotel. Oh, yeah. I had two friends there, Izzy Stein and this other boy, Charlie Dinert. And everything was service. You couldn't spend, and went down to get a haircut, and here was old Dave Cork Marsh. He was cross-eyed. You wonder how he ever could cut your hair, you know. He'd been here, nothing doing. You couldn't spend a cent. And we took in the Barbary Coast and the whole work. So then, this one was leaving Frisco, the flu broke out.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So when we got back to Camp Dodge in Iowa, there must have been between 50 and 60,000 soldiers. Mm-hmm. And say that flu, that was something to go through. Mm-hmm. Us boys didn't get sick. We had to go up and be orderlies in the hospital. And they'd take up maybe 1,000 or 2,000 of us of a night, and they'd say 2 here, 4 here, 6 there. And while we were standing there, you'd see the boys drop them. And so I went along there, and there wasn't none of us left at the company, and only about a dozen of us or so. And they take us up every day and put us in these wards, and the only one thing they said, never drink moonshine. Well, them days they used to bring a can of milk in a 10-gallon can. And the cream always come to the top, you know. So between the moonshine and the cream, we didn't get the flu.
That was your secret.
That was our secret. So, but they tell you not to drink whiskey, you know. So I went up to this hospital. Well, I was on there for about 2 weeks. And I was in the pneumonia ward there, and about 1 o'clock of the morning, they started dying off. Oh, boy, it was awful. So the last night I was there, I couldn't keep my eyes open anymore or anything like that. I mean, on the daytime, it was so hot, and then about midnight, these electrical storms had come up. So I went to this doctor, he was a major, and so I said, Doc, I've been on here 2 weeks now, and everything is just blurring. So he says, there's a chair over there, and he went and got one of these partitions and put in front of me and went to sleep. Well, as luck as it was, my best friend, Charlie Dynick, he died. Mm. So they asked me to take him to Chicago. So I got out of it then. Mm. But it was awful there, the way the boys died. Mm. Yeah. And so then, after the war's over, the 11th of November, I was laying around there, just laying around doing nothing, you know. So the little boy down here, his name was Al Brennan. So he says, I want to get back to Fairbanks in the spring so I can go back to work for the railroad. And he says, I got a garter, and he says, I want it taken care of before I go back. And he said, I'm going down and see if I can't get out. Well, I said, if you got a garter, I got a garter too. So rundown about the 1st of January. And we put in, and so the doctors took us in and looked us over and told us strip down and looked at our throat and our chest and told us to hold our arms up, and we had a little quiver. And so they turned us loose.
Yeah.
And so they gave us enough money and paid our fare when we come back on the train, you know. And so when I left Rockford, or down Camp Grant of Rockford, Illinois, so I took a Chicago, Milwaukee, no, one of the other trains up to Milwaukee. Well, that was the last night for Milwaukee, and the last place to go ride was Wisconsin. Well, believe me, the booze wasn't floating high that night. And I had to lay over there 6 hours waiting for the Chicago-Milwaukee Railroad. And of course, I had a uniform on, and you couldn't have a drink then. So a fella told me to go in there and get an overcoat. I got an overcoat, and believe me, I joined the crowd.
Overcoat over your uniform.
Yeah. So there that I left there on the next morning after midnight. I don't know how. But anyway, we was on our way to Seattle. So I hung around Seattle there for about 3 weeks, and Joe O'Connor's, maybe you heard of the O'Connor boys, Pat O'Connor and Joe O'Connor's. There was an old time family. He just got out of the army. And I said, "Where are you going, Joe?" He says, "I'm hitting for Fairbanks." Well, I said, "I'll go with you." So we took the old Admiral Evans up and landed in Cordova. And so we was wondering how in the heck we was going to get into Fairbanks. We didn't have too much cash, you know. So we had enough cash to take us up to Chittenden on the old Copper River. When I got to Copper River, why, first fellow I run into was old Bob Bartlett's dad.
Bob Bartlett's dad?
Yeah, Ed. So he says, "Where are you going, Creamer?" I said, "I'm going to try to make Fairbanks." So the NC company had lost a contract, and there's a GPO outfit had the mail contract, you know. So he's down there with a team of horses and a team of mules. So, he says, "If you're going to Fairbanks," he says, "come on and drive the team in for me and I'll pay all your expenses." Well, I says, "What I'm going to do is Joe O'Connor." Well, he says, "He can drive the mules."
Good.
So, we had, them days it's all double-enders, you know, and I had 3 double-enders.
3?
Yeah, and I had 7 passengers, and I had the old Marshall Irwin. They called him Stub Irwin, and I'm guessing before your days. And he went outside and got married, and some with her, and she had a kid about 10 or 12 years old. So he wouldn't sit with the rest of the passengers. He had to sit in the last double ender. And so I started out with him and made good time. And so when I got to Miller's Roadhouse, I'd come quite a distance that day. And so he was in a hurry to get to Fairbanks, and he says, "I'll go on down to Yost." Well, as a judge, I traveled a long ways to the day, and I says, "That's the toughest country there is on the whole trail." So we fought it out, and he got mad, and I wouldn't move, you know, because that was dangerous. You go down through Yost there and in through Paxton's. Well, there at Yost, they had a cable across the valley there, and they had bells on it. So if people got lost, they'd hit the cable, and the bell would bring them into the roadhouse. So I stayed there that night, and I pulled out, and I made Yost and went on, and everything went fine then. But he told me I'd never get another job in Fairbanks.
Oh, he was that important.
Yeah. So when we got to Sullivan's there at Delta, I was going down the Delta there when we hit the town of rivers, the wind was blowing again. And it was glare ice. And with three double Emmys, you know, behind two horses, you know what it was. And so I was working my way over to get over to the shore. So, you know how the shore ice is, it hangs, and the river ice, it drops with a crack there, and about 4 inches difference. So I kept working the horses in circles, and we kept working over it, and so God, finally the wind caught us, and when I hit the sleds, it dumped old Judge and his wife out. And he was so short and fat, he rolled like a barrel. Well, he's still madder at me. So I drove on into the fox farm at noon, and then we went down to Munson's Roadhouse and stayed there that night. And then the next day I made it into Fairbanks. And so we got rid of the passengers, but I left at the same airline. There was a man and a woman who was living together. And I don't know why he had it on her. For this bookkeeper, he was a bookkeeper, you know. So by gosh, in 3 weeks he turned around and gave me $10 a day to be a Secret Service man. So I hung on that job for about 21 days. So I'd see the guy go in there, but I didn't have no authority to go in the house, you know. And so after 21 days, he says, "You ain't doing a damn thing for me or getting anything on this guy." And he says, "You're a cat."
You're a poor detective.
So that kept me in the spot. So then in the early days here, I know one spring, why old Dave Lady, he was running a tent and awning shop over there on 3rd and Lacey. And he put up a nice rink down on the river and covered up with the tent. Oh. I was there helping him run this rink. And he's doing a good business and everything. So then one night about Christmas time, a wind come up and just blew the tent to shreds. So I was out of a rink. So maybe a lot of people know Mrs. Cecil Cascart. And then Mrs. Jack Ray was here then. Ray was the head man of the Dominion Commercial Company. So they had no rink, so Mrs. Ray and Mrs. Cashcart, they went around and sold tickets for $5 a piece. And they took up a pretty good collection. They come to me and asked me if I'd start a skating rink. And that was down here in front of the NC Company. So the NC Company, they gave me light and everything was furnished, hot water from the hydrants, you know. And so I did pretty good. They took in $500, and that was in February. Well, the rink only lasted until about the 20th of March, you know. So then another time, Gordon Rink was over here where the clinic is now, and that faded out. So Gordon come to me and he says, "I wonder if we can't make a skating rink out of it." So I thought it over, and of course them days we didn't have this bisqueen and everything. All we had was tar paper. So I went to my uncle, Fred Noyes, and I got the sawdust from him, and I put this tar paper down on this hardwood floor and put about 3 inches of sawdust, and then went in with the spray and nozzled around and made a nice rink out of it. On a hardwood floor. So I run the rink that winter, and he did a wonderful business because it was indoor, nice and warm, you could hold a certain temperature. Well, then when spring come, we tore off the ice and the sawdust and took up the tar paper, and then he had a nice skating rink again.
Oh, roller skating. Oh.
But then days roller skating was big because we used to have their Montana races, 26 mile races. Ooh. And there were big prizes put up.
Indoor races.
Indoors, yeah. Roller skating, you know. Then they had over there where the FE company is now. They had a big racetrack, and we used to hold the marathon races there. Yeah. and 26 miles.
Oh.
And that big money put up, you know.
What year was that?
Well, that must have been around 1910, even through there, you know.
When did you start your dairy?
Well, I left here and I've been working for the railroad, and so my wife, she wanted me to come outside and get married, and so I quit the railroad in 20 and went out.
Where'd you meet your wife, and what was her name?
Rosanna Golden.
Rosanna Golden.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you first meet her?
Here in Fairbanks. She'd been married before and had a grocery store. And so her and her husband split up, and so she'd went outside, and so in 20, so she asked me to take a trip out and we'd get married. And so I was out there, folks were living out there at Ridgefield, Washington. And so she didn't want to leave her folks, so we bought a little chicken ranch. We went to the chicken business, you know, the feathered style. And so, well, we did fine. We were making good money. And then in about 1925, the Depression started. And every year it kept getting worse. Well, I was up to 10,000 chickens. So in 27, I had all these broilers. And I'd take them down to Swift and Company, and where I used to get 40 cents, they give me 15 cents.
For a whole chicken?
Yeah. So I said to my wife, I said, by gosh, it's time to move up. So I took 1,500 of these broilers and 500 hens and a cow and 40 cases of the eggs, and I headed back for Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Well, so on the way up, I gave the crew the eggs from the hens, and they fed the hens all the scraps, and that was the year all the seagulls starved.
Nothing went overboard for the seagulls.
So, made it into Fairbanks here, and so these people were hungry for fresh meat. So I took them over to my mother's home, dad's home in Gray Oak, and I didn't have to peddle them. They come over there in these roosters. They give me $1.50 a piece for them. They go home and kill them. There's no butchering in the hens. They give me from $4 to $5.
15 cents a piece in Seattle and $1.50 in Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks. Well, the people are hungry for chicken, you know. So the broilers, they didn't last long. But the hens, we had them all summer. And my mother had them there. And by fall, they were all gone. Of course, they were $4 to $4.50 and $5. And Swift and Company in Seattle or in Portland was offering me 75 cents for it. So then I stayed here and I helped my brother-in-law. He was running the dairy.
Oh, the dairy was already in operation.
Yeah, Hinckley was running it then.
Hinckley.
Yeah, and he was my brother-in-law. So I stayed there that summer and helped him get his crops in and out. In the fall, we pulled out. So I met Charlie Fowler, and so he told me if I'd come back in the spring, he'd give me a job on the shovels up on the Chattanooga Ditch. So I went out and spent the winter, and the next spring I come back. So in March, so I stayed out there with my brother-in-law. And that's about the time I had to go to work for the FE company. And my brother-in-law says, we're getting old, why don't you buy us a house? The guys, after paying the bills outside and everything, I didn't have too much money. So I asked him what he wanted, and he said he wanted $6,000 cash and the balance on time. Well, I didn't have near that much, but I knew an old Irishman, maybe some of you people here remember him, was Billy McGrath.
Right.
He had his money laying down here in Pinsky's store. I guess old Pinsky is using it. So I went and put the cards on the table to him, and And them days it was 12% interest. So I needed $6,000. And so he dished it up to me. So with $6,000 I bought out of Hinckley, and after a month I was in business, old Charlie Slater come to me and wanted me to buy him out. Mm. You remember Charlie Slater?
Sure.
So what did I have to do? But I had to go back to my brother-in-law and borrow this money to buy Slater out.
Then you had all the Slaterville property?
No, no. I just bought his cow.
Oh, just his cow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I bought him out. I says, only about 2 months, I was $20,000 in debt. I says, I wonder where I was going to get off that. So everything was going fine. I was making the payments. And of course, them days, the depression was long outside. You could land a